Family, this is New Hampshire Public Radio News at 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. In a society awash in data, it's easier than ever to take all the numbers out there and use them to promote your worldview. Here's an example from the field of politics, where statistics are often manipulated. When Democrats in Illinois raised the state income tax, they said that the income tax had only been increased by 2 percentage points, from 3% to 5%. Doesn't sound too terrible, but Republicans interpreted the numbers differently, saying that the state income tax rate had gone up by 67%, which sounds like a much bigger bite out of your wallet. So who's right? Well, our guest today says both are, and that's the beauty of and problem with statistics. We're talking this hour with Charles Whelan, former correspondent for The Economist magazine, a professor at Dartmouth College, and author of the brand new book, Naked Statistics. In it, Whelan explores how this field has exploded given the proliferation of data today and is being used to explore key questions from why autism seems to be on the rise to what teaching methods best lead to student success to who among us might end up committing a crime. Today in The Exchange, the new rock star status of statistics. Charles Whelan is our guest, and we'll look at the themes in his book. Let's hear from you, too. How do you see statistics being used and misused today? How do you think this field is helping us better understand the world around us? Or how is it distorting that understanding? Give us a call, The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email if you'd like, exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. And Professor Whelan, great to have you. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, it's good to be with you. Thanks.
Well, before listeners who struggled through statistics courses in high school or college shut off their radios, Professor Whelan, thinking there's no way I'm going to listen to an hour on this, hold on, folks, because Professor Whelan, I want to give you the chance to make your case that statistics are, as you say in the book, fun.
Well, Hal Varian at Google, the chief economist, has gone so far as to say the statistics are sexy.
Wow.
And that may be an oversell. I don't know. This book may not be appropriate for Valentine's Day. I'm not going to go that far. But it is unequivocally true that we are surrounded by data, and statistics are simply the tools that we use to simplify and put some form around the data. So why is that going on? Well, in part because if you went to a retailer 20 years ago, somebody manually imprinted your credit card, and then they pulled the tag off whatever you were buying. They put them both in a box, never to be seen again. You fast forward to today, someone swipes your credit card. They scan what you're buying. They may swipe your frequent buyer card. And all of those things say things about you. Then they're aggregated with data from hundreds of thousands of other shoppers, and suddenly somebody sitting in Los Angeles knows how many Gap khakis were sold in size 34 when the temperature was warm. So this marriage of digital data, cheap computing power, searchability on the internet means that the data era and therefore the statistics era is here to stay.
So there's so much more out there because there's just so many more numbers out there, and they're easier and easier to collect and aggregate and use for purposes for marketing, for example.
For all kinds of purposes. The beauty of statistics, as you said in your intro, is that they simplify. So a good example would be you go to college, you take 35 classes, there are exams, homework, you get different grades. You can send me a transcript, and it's going to say how you did in each one of those courses. You could probably even send me the graded exams if you wanted to be in a big box. Or you can put one number at the top of your resume, which is your grade point average, your GPA. Now, the benefit of the GPA is I get it. It's simple. It's one number. I can compare it across people. That's all good. The drawback, and this is going to be true with all descriptive statistics and many other of the statistical tools, is we lose information in the process. We don't know what courses you took. We don't know what your major was. We don't know how hard those courses were or the university. So that is an inherent conundrum when we start using statistics to simplify and tell stories.
Right, and I think we'll touch on that again and again this hour, Professor Whelan, you know, the sort of light side and dark side of statistics. And what you just said about what statistics tell us and what they don't tell us in that simplification process brings up the old quote, I have to say it, from the beloved Mark Twain, who said there are lies, damned lies, and statistics. What's Twain saying there?
Well, he's saying that statistics have a point of view. And I would add to Twain's insight that statistics are never smarter wiser or more honest than the people using them. So think about a courtroom where, by law, the defense attorney and the prosecuting attorney have access to all the same information. That's the discovery process. We're very clear in this system that they all have to see the same stuff. But obviously, when we go to trial, the prosecuting attorney and the defense attorney are going to present that information or not present pieces of it in very different kinds of ways. And they both of them may be honest in a literal sense that they're not lying. But of course, like online dating or anything else, you can leave things out. You can shade things in ways that are not technically perjury or dishonesty, but still may be misleading. Or if you want to be more charitable about it, have a point of view.
So can statistics lead us to truth, Professor Whelan, or not?
They can lead us in the right direction. Another aphorism that I like, while we're going to stick with the aphorisms for a while, is it's easy to lie with statistics. It's much easier to lie without them. So data generally inform what's going on, but they can lead us wildly off track. One of the points I make early in the book is this distinction between precision and accuracy. Data are often about precision, and that's simply the exactitude with which we express something. So your speedometer may tell you you're going 62.5 miles an hour. Your GPS device might tell you that you're 21.3 miles from where you're going. The problem is that precision may or may not be accurate. Accurate is how closely the figure resembles the underlying reality. So if your GPS device is broken, I don't know if you saw that story a couple weeks ago about the woman who drove 900 miles out of her way in Europe because she was just following the GPS. She literally drove across Europe. At one point, she slept on the side of the road. It's because at that point, she had abandoned common sense and she had confused precision for accuracy. And in more serious examples, I would argue that's kind of what happened on Wall Street with some of the models that were broken. So you have to be very careful about what the statistics tell you that's valuable, moves you in the right direction, like gathering clues at a crime scene, but it can also lead you off track if you turn off your brain.
Our phone number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Again, today in The Exchange, we're talking with author and Dartmouth professor Charles Whelan. His book is called Naked Statistics, Stripping the Dread from the Data. Give us a call if you dreaded statistics yourself when you were a student, or if you see the usefulness of statistics in our world around us today. 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. And what's so great about the book, Professor Whelan, is you write about how we encounter basic statistical concepts everywhere. It's highly, highly relevant to our lives. I want to talk to you about a couple examples that come up every day. Number one, don't ever buy a warranty. You know, you buy the toaster oven or you buy the, you know, the whatever, and the very earnest clerk says, you should buy this warranty and it's good for a year or two if, you know, such and such ever breaks down. You say, don't buy it.
A warranty is just a form of insurance, and insurance is just a form of probability. So whoever's selling you the insurance, whether it's Allstate, Geico, whether it's fire, home, auto, or the $99 printer, is doing some calculations based on past data. They're saying, all right, well, how often does this house burn down? How often does this person total their car? When that happens, how much is it going to cost us? How frequently is it going to happen across all the people that we insure? And once we know that, what premiums do we have to charge all of these people in order to make more than we pay out, right? They're in this business to make a profit.
Sure.
So you turn around to look at it from the other direction, which is, okay, you're the policyholder. And the reason you get insurance and you should get insurance for things like your car and your home is it's actually unlikely that your home is going to burn down. But if it does, it's going to be a devastating event. So if I come to you and I say, you know, on average, you're going to pay more in premiums than you're likely to get back in the event of some really bad outcome, like totaling your car or your house burning down, you're going to say rightfully, well, that's fine, because what I'm doing is I'm protecting against this contingency that I cannot afford to have happen. So let's take the same concept down to something like the toaster oven, the $99 printer. These are also for-profit firms. When you go to Best Buy and they're aggressively hawking the warranty, and they do that when you go to the checkout, they've done the calculation. They're saying, all right, well, these printers actually don't break very often, so we're going to take in a lot more in warranty money than we're going to pay out for broken printers. Again, turn that around, which means you're going to pay out more in extended warranty payments than you're going to get back from broken cheap utilities. Well, this is different than the home or the car in that if that $99 printer breaks, it's not going to change the trajectory of your life. So you don't really need to protect against it. And if you don't really need to protect against it, then on average, you're just going to be paying more out in these warranties than you're going to get back. It's a bad bet, which makes it a good bet for the business selling them to you.
Well, and I was relieved to read it because they always make you feel really guilty and nervous when you don't buy them. There's another...
Right.
Go ahead.
They're making a lot more money. I mean, the market for printers and toaster ovens is really competitive. Their margin on that is actually quite small.
Right.
So they can amplify their profits enormously if they sell these extended warranties. That's why they're not really worried about you and your broken toaster oven.
And that's a basic statistical concept, right, Professor Whelan? Probability, risk. That's what we're getting at
data.
Here.
Oh, this is coin flipping taken to much more sophisticated levels. It's just figuring out on average what's going to happen. It's not going to happen to everybody. We don't know ex ante who's going to total their car, but we have pretty good data on over a large population what proportion of those cars will be totaled. We don't know who's going to die tomorrow, but we have very good information on how long the average person will live. And it's about taking that math and then formulating a business model around it that in many cases is good for the company doing business, but can also be good for you who is insuring against some risk.
Okay, and here's another example, again from daily life. You say, and this is not going to be popular in New Hampshire, where lottery proceeds help fund public schools, but you say don't ever, ever, ever buy a lottery ticket. Statistically, a ridiculous idea.
Well, let's just unpack what you said. Lottery proceeds fund public schools. Ergo, the lottery is making money. On average, they're taking more in ticket sales than they're paying out. That ought to tell you something right away. The odds of the lottery are terrible. In fact, there's a funny anecdote in the book where I actually bought a lottery ticket in Chicago, in part because on the back by law, it has to tell you what the expected payouts are. So there's a 1 in 10,000 chance you'll make $500 and so on. And you can add all those up and do what's called an expected value calculation. You'll know on average what the payout is for a ticket. So for every dollar ticket, if I recall correctly, the payout was about 60 cents, which is clearly a bad bet. But the irony is that I actually won with that ticket. So I bought a ticket to prove what a bad idea it was, and it turned out to be a winning ticket. I did note that in a footnote. So I was honest about the disclosure.
Let's take some calls after a short break and a lot more questions about statistics, their use and misuse in our daily lives. More with professor and author Charles Whelan after a short break.
It's The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio. Good morning. As the country debates where to draw the line between gun control and gun rights, NHPR examines New Hampshire's long relationship with guns. Loaded Issue is a special series of reports from the NHPR newsroom that's charting the many nuances of these stories. Catch reports all next week on Morning Edition, All Things Considered, and at nhpr.org. Support for NHPR comes from you, our members, and from Great Glen Trails Outdoor Center, offering cross-country skiing, snowshoeing, snow tubing, and daily winter tours to Mount Washington's tree line aboard the snow coach, greatglentrails.com. And from Pelletieri Associates, Warner Landscape Architectural Firm, celebrating 30 years of landscape architecture, construction, and fine gardening services, a proud supporter of NHPR. This is NHPR. It's 920.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, statistics without the struggle. A Dartmouth professor offers up his ideas on how statistics can be, he says, fun. The name of his book is called Naked Statistics, Stripping the Dread from the Data. The author is Charles Whelan. And we're talking this hour about how statistics are used and misused today. Give us a call. How do you see this analysis tool, this way of interpreting data, being used to help us understand the world around us? How is statistics used to help help us misunderstand what's happening around us? Our number, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. And Professor Whelan, let's go right to our callers. And Chris joins us from Amherst. Hi, Chris. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Well, good morning.
Morning.
Thank you. It's nice to be here. I am a growing researcher at this point, and I'm struggling with actually trying to assess the roots of school violence and how we make a difference. And I've come up with things I've found in bodies of research consistently over and over and over again. And I don't know how to frame it so that I can get people to pay attention. It feels like the truth to me. it's positive identity development and helping kids manage strong emotions and protecting their safety socially. How do I present it? How do I frame it in a way? We have decades of research that tells us how to stop this. How do I get people to read it and care?
Well, Chris, where are the statistics in there?
Where are the statistics?
Yeah.
Okay. The foundations for what I am saying come from decades of research across all sorts of educational and development juvenile justice research. And I have found a way. I have found a way to begin to assess them. I'm in the proposal phase. To be honest, I think higher ed is, they fight it. They want me to nail it down and cut it up into little pieces. But in the end, how do you cut earning a child's trust into little pieces? That is the bottom line.
Really hard to present, huh? And how to use all that data and what to present. And as Chris said, Professor Whelan, how do I get this in a way that will make people understand, that will help them understand what I'm trying to say here? It's tough.
Well, the first tough thing is that the subject itself is very hard to study. So this is like so many topics in social science research where we cannot do controlled experiments. So when it comes to things like drugs, violence, we cannot have a control group and an experimental group and say, all right, well, let's have this group smoke marijuana in high school and see what happens to their earnings. So instead, what we're left doing is looking across some very large population. We may have data on 40,000 people over 10 years, and they tell us about their lives. They tell us how they felt when they were kids. They tell us about their drug use. They tell us about their education. And then we have outcomes. Some people turn violent. Some become criminals. Some get PhDs. And we have to make associations between those things. But because it's not a controlled experiment, it's very hard to prove causality. So let's look at one, for example. I don't know the violence literature very much, but I do know that as shocking as these incidents are, there aren't very many of them. So it's extremely hard to make a connection between attributes that may be involved and the outcomes that we don't like. Anytime it's a small sample, it gets tough. But let's look at a different one in the same space, which is let's look at drug use in, say, early childhood, like junior high, and later outcomes, say, dropping out of high school. We may find an association between those two things. But even then, we cannot be sure that it's a causal association. So it may well be that kids who are smoking marijuana in junior high have a host of other social problems that explain both the drug use and the later dropping out of high school. Now, good research will try and control for those things, but it's very hard to do. So I think what the caller has hinted at is just this larger challenge of social science research when we're all, by definition of what we're looking at, we're unable to do controlled experiments, and therefore the truth is always going to be somewhat elusive.
Yeah, it's tricky. So statistics in the social sciences, especially difficult, because you're right, you can't put one group of kids in a room and say, okay, smoke pot for a year, and another kid's in the room and say, don't smoke pot for a year. You have to infer after the fact. You also have to assume that people are telling the truth. But we all know that when people are interviewed about their behaviors, they often shade that truth a little bit.
They may not even know they're shading in the truth. So there's an interesting example of what's called recall bias in the book. And there was a large group of women who had been diagnosed with breast cancer. And then there was another control group who had not been diagnosed with breast cancer. And they were both asked about their dietary habits over the last 10 or 15 years. And the women who'd been diagnosed with breast cancer reported that they had eaten more fat and generally their diet had been less healthy. And, you know, this was assumed to be that, or perhaps this is a causal element in the eventual illness. Well, the twist in the experiment was that the researchers actually knew what the women had eaten because they'd all been participants in a different dietary study. And what was discovered was that the women who had been diagnosed with breast cancer exaggerated the degree to which they'd eaten unhealthy stuff, in part because I think they were searching for some causal explanation of the illness themselves.
Wow, they were blaming themselves.
They were blaming themselves. So by virtue of being diagnosed, it actually changed their memories of their own diets when we compared this with some objective real-time assessment of what they've been eating.
Well, Chris, good luck with your research, and thanks for calling. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. And Professor Whelan, since you brought up that breast cancer example, let's talk more broadly about how statistics are used in medicine, especially reporting on health breakthroughs. You write that there are a lot of misunderstandings, misinterpretations there.
A lot of it gets to the same basic problem, which is, let's suppose we have some huge study of 40 or 50,000 people, and there are these huge data sets, and researchers can troll through the data looking for interesting things, and we discover that eating broccoli is associated with better health outcomes. Then you have to ask the same basic question, which is, okay, is there something about eating broccoli that actually makes people healthier, and that's plausible? Or is it something about people who eat broccoli? They probably floss more, they exercise more, they ride their bikes more. And if the research isn't done well, then we may simply be picking up things that are associated with eating broccoli rather than the broccoli itself. And that, you know, that's the most benign problem that can happen. Once you get into medical research, particularly pharmaceutical trials and things of that nature, then people do have a powerful interest in positive results, and that too can bias the outcomes that you see.
Yeah. So is there, again, I asked you this earlier, but it comes up with the medical examples. Can you discern some truth when you use statistics in medicine?
Only if you're skeptical. So one of the things that we've discovered by studying the studies is that many of the breakthroughs are subsequently recanted. Mm. And there are a number of reasons for this. They don't necessarily have to be even nefarious. So, for example, one of the things we know about data, particularly in the medical field, is there's something called publication bias. So let's suppose that you do a large study and you find that taking antioxidants does not actually help with cancer. And you take it to the medical journals and they say, well, you know, that's not that interesting. We want things that solve cancer, that prevent it. And so 99 people out there come to this finding that, you know, this thing doesn't actually have much medical value. Now, I come along with the 100th study and I say, hey, I just found that antioxidants are preventive of cancer. Well, that's a much more encouraging, interesting study. So there's a decent chance that for reasons that are well-intentioned or maybe just because we've overlooked all the studies that didn't find anything worthwhile, that my positive finding is more likely to get published. So on average, when you see these exciting medical findings, you have to ask yourself, and the journals are getting better at this, are there other studies out there, perhaps many other studies that did not come to this finding, but because that's not very exciting, they didn't actually get into print?
Yeah. Well, in a way, how much are we complicit in this? It's a complicated world. Most people don't have time to dig into the fact that there were, you know, X number of other studies with different conclusions and so forth. Most of us are busy and we're just trying to get through our day and we want somebody else to do the analysis. You know, it's easy, it's quick, and it helps us feel like we understand the world a little bit better.
Yeah, I think the danger is if it's like letting anybody do anything else. If they have a particular axe to grind or they're not particularly good at what they're doing, then you are the victim of whatever poor statistical or misleading work gets sent your direction. So I do think it's kind of like personal finance and other areas where a certain amount of literacy is an important part of being an informed citizen. And if you're not, then you go through life at your peril.
And then you get to the other extreme, though, where to the point where people don't believe anything that science or research tells them. You know, they just say, nah, it's all biased. I don't believe any of it.
Right. And I think that's equally problematic in the sense that we do have data. And because we have more data than ever before, we can make new inferences. We can do exciting things. So let me give you an example of where I think data have been very helpful and statistics are the tool that we analyze them. And that would be law enforcement. So in the past, so 20 years ago, if there were an armed robbery someplace, there'd be an arrest report, and it would go on carbon paper in triplicate, and the files would go in different folders, and they'd be stuck in different boxes, and they go in the basement someplace. It would be very hard, if not prohibitive, to kind of aggregate all those arrest reports. Well, now we can enter all those data in real time, and we can see where the hotspots are. So if you read about CompStat and other things like that, we can say, boy, there are a lot of crimes happening at 3 p.m. in this particular neighborhood. Maybe we should send a couple extra squad cars over there. This, along with a lot of other things, is one reason that violent crime has been falling systematically over the last couple of decades. There are a lot of other things going on. I don't want to oversell the statistic, but we are better at law enforcement because of the use of data. Now, that, of course, breeds its own ethical dilemmas, and maybe we'll go in that direction as well.
All right, let's go back to our callers. And the number here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Waiting in Conway is Jeff. Go ahead, Jeff. You're on the air. Welcome.
Thank you. Good morning, Laura. Always a great show. Professor Whalen, thank you for speaking to us today. I'm actually calling from a statistical analysis company. We produce software that we sell to all kinds of institutions, higher ed institutions, healthcare institutions. You were talking about healthcare. A lot of our healthcare customers are looking to mitigate their readmit risks. So they're looking at information that they already have on hand in order to get a sense of what conditions are prone to readmission from the standpoint of infection or just poor treatment or maltreatment. There are lots of applications from the standpoint of healthcare. From the aspect of, the hospital or the physician who's actually performing the function and trying to get a handle on what risks their patients are going to be encountering.
Yeah.
But I wanted to make a point about how statistics are influencing people that they may not realize are impacting them. A lot of our customers are in the higher ed realm, and a lot of the folks that we sell the software to are in admissions, as an example. And what they'll do is take records from folks who had applied in the past and had gone on to be accepted or not accepted, gone on to be enrolled or not enrolled, and get a sense of who their best prospects are, and then evaluate them individually, actually assigning.
Okay, Jeff, can I jump in here for a second?
Sure.
First, you start off talking about hospital admissions,
yes.
Right? And
yes.
Now you're talking about college admissions, so two different
Correct.
Things there. Just want to make sure I got
yeah.
that right. Okay.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's okay. That's all right.
In the case of colleges,
okay.
What you'll have is people who are applying to attend a particular college, and they'll take the software, apply it to those individuals, and use the statistical model that they've developed based upon past behavior, past applicants, and get a sense of who their best applicants are and focus on those folks from
yeah.
the standpoint of literature and the standpoint of people contacting them, reaching out to them.
And Jeff, let me jump in here, okay, because these are two huge questions, and I'm glad you called because both of these come up in the book. Boy, we could do a whole hour on how statistics are being used and sometimes misused in healthcare. Professor Whalen, you have a story in the book, for example, about cardiology and how the use of statistics and risk in cardiac surgery is possibly hurting some patients.
This is a great example. First, I want to acknowledge the caller's point that in healthcare, the infection example is a really good one where data help us out. So I've seen, it's not in the book, but examples where when doctors wear neckties are vectors for infections. So if you get rid of the tie, you may not look as professional, but it's actually really good for your patients.
Really?
Shaking hands is another thing. The first thing you do is shake hands with your patients, but a lot of doctors forget to wash their hands. So if you lose the shaking hands, it's going to be better. So, and we're talking about huge numbers of deaths. So, you know, something on the order of 100,000 people die of hospital infections in the United States. So this is one where we have a problem. We look at the data, we figure out what's going on, and we make it better, and that's important. Now, the cardiologist example is one where we have a problem, we look at the data, and we make it worse. The example you're referring to seemed so benign. The state of New York was concerned, as we all are, about mortality figures among doctors, particularly cardiologists, and they figured they could do the public a service by just publishing the mortality data for cardiologists for a single procedure. I believe it was angioplasty. What's not to like about that? We would all like more information. Consumer Reports helps us buy washing machines. Why shouldn't we have similar information when we're shopping around for a heart doctor? Well, the danger here, and this is true any time you're evaluating people with data and they have control over the data to some extent, is that cardiologists are not going to go to work and say, boy, I'm going to improve my outcomes here by killing fewer people. Because presumably they're already working very hard to do that. Instead, they're going to say, and there was a follow-up survey where some 70% of them did say this, that, boy, I can make my numbers look a little better if I don't take the sickest patients. That those folks who are in dire, dire shape are the most likely to die in my care. If I don't take them, my mortality rates will improve. Well, the upshot of that is that those folks who are the sickest now find it hardest to get a cardiologist.
Because they drag the guy's numbers down.
Right. That's clearly not what was intended.
Wow. That's a stunning story. When I read that in the book, I thought, okay, that's a clear misuse of statistics. Another area where you say statistics is sometimes misused is in our caller's other example, education. Now, he talked about higher education. You write about standardized tests in schools being used to judge students, being used to judge the quality of teachers, and you've got some problems with that.
Well, anytime you use data to evaluate someone, that's first and foremost a good thing, right? I mean, you don't want to be randomly promoting people, randomly paying people more. And so there's the old aphorism in management that you can't manage what you can't measure. I go one step further and say, all right, well, let's be very careful about whether what you're measuring is truly what you care about. And in the case of standardized tests, we have ample examples from lots of different places that when you put more and more emphasis on standardized tests, in particularly in K through 12, that it can lead to some pernicious behavior. So there's one example from Florida, I don't think it's in the book, where the state started getting more serious about standardized testing. There was a loophole, though, which is that students who were evaluated to have special needs were exempt from the test results that were evaluated by the state. Well, not surprisingly, what happened in Florida, it's a little like the cardiologist, is that the school suddenly started coding kids as having learning disabilities because they were the lowest test takers and they wanted to get them out of the test-taking population. That is probably borderline legal, but it's clearly not what was intended. In the case of Atlanta, listeners may remember, we had a huge cheating scandal. And that was a case where teachers, you know, they didn't teach to the test, which is what we always worry about. They simply changed the answer sheets. Now, the funny thing about this is that their cheating was caught by statistics.
Right.
There are now private sector firms that you can hire to catch cheaters. And what they do, among they got a lot of different tools. One of them is they look for answer sheets in which students get a lot of easy questions wrong and a lot of harder questions right, which shouldn't be the pattern that you see. They look for erasures. So if you've got a disproportionate number of erasures from wrong to right, that should be a relatively random thing. But if they're all going wrong to right, then you want to look for cheating. And, of course, in Atlanta, they found cheating.
Yeah, and again, using core statistical tools to solve some of these big questions. Jeff, thanks a lot for those questions. And we'll take more of your calls after a short break. 1-800-892-6477. Keep it right here.
It's 9:39 and you're listening to The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio, where support comes from you, our members, and from Living Innovations, with fulfilling job opportunities for those interested in helping seniors and people with disabilities at home and in the community, online at livinginnovations.com. And from Hinckley, Allen & Snyder, where partners have been giving clients practical legal advice for over 100 years throughout New England, online at haslaw.com. This is NHPR. It's 9:40.
Today on Word of Mouth, love with a 25% interest rate. If you're planning to propose on February 14th, we'll give you some tips to avoid falling into the diamond credit pit. And the original Luddite. Why does Ned Ludd, who sparked a violent rebellion in the industrial era, continue to captivate in the information age? I'm Virginia Prescott. Word of Mouth rages against the machine. Today at noon and again at 9 on NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on The Exchange, a New Hampshire take on the immigration debate unfolding now on Capitol Hill. Email us your questions at nhpr.org before the program and join us tomorrow morning live at 9. Today in The Exchange, statistics without the struggle. We're talking with Dartmouth professor and author Charles Whelan about his new book, Naked Statistics, Stripping the Dread from the Data. We've been looking at all the different ways statistics is used and misused in our society today, from education to health, to whether you should play the lottery or not. Our guest says absolutely not, by the way. Let's take another call, Professor Whelan, if we could. And Sheila's waiting in Concord. Hi, Sheila, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. My husband was recently advised not to have his prostate cancer treated because of a really large study that was done over a number of years that showed that statistically men who had treatment did no better than men who didn't have treatment and who had his stage of cancer. So you look at this study, and it was a really big study, and it went over a lot of years, and you think, wow, that sounds really convincing. But my question is, Is it true that, or are there any caveats when you look at these really large studies involving a large number of people versus smaller studies, which you would think were inherently less reliable?
Yeah, it's really tricky, Sheila. Thanks for calling. It's really tricky, Professor Whelan, for the average person to evaluate this stuff.
In general, larger is better, but if it's a poorly conceived study, then larger just makes it worse because it appears more precise when in fact it's just sloppy. So I'll give you a polling example, and then we can come back to prostate cancer because it is a very good example. So if you're conducting a telephone poll and you want to know about American political attitudes, what is essential is to get a representative sample of American households. You want voters who kind of look like America. They got to be all geographic entities, races, ages, and so on. And if you do that of about 1,500 households that really represent America, you will get shockingly accurate results. If for some reason you only call people in New York City or Washington, D.C. or Texas, your poll is going to be meaningless. And if you call 100,000 people in Washington, D.C. or Texas, it's meaningless and it's going to look more impressive. So bigger can be better if you do it right, and it's deceiving if you do it wrong. Now, back to prostate cancer. I mean, I'm not a doctor, so we're going to make that important caveat. But there are a number of prostate cancer examples in the book. And I'll give you just two studies that I'm aware of that make some of this nuance very apparent. One was a very big study that found those who had been treated for prostate cancer did have slightly lower rates of subsequent death from prostate cancer. And that would argue, boy, I should get this treated. The same study, though, found that the overall mortality rate wasn't any lower. So the people who didn't die of prostate cancer died of something else. And on the whole, both groups lived about the same amount of time. So that, you know, that suggests that stuff that's consistent with what the caller said, which is this may not necessarily be a disease that needs to be treated aggressively because it is so slow growing.
Well, so this gets back to what we talked about earlier, Professor Whelan. What advice do you have for the layperson, like Sheila, like a lot of our listeners, who want to be able to figure this out? I mean, the more I hear you talk, the more I think, I can't believe anything I read.
Well, the first and most important thing is anything you see once may well be an aberration.
All right.
What you want to see is stuff that's corroborated. When you start to see a series of studies with good methodologies but not identical methodologies, so looking at the same question from different ways, when they start to find conclusive results such as smoking and cancer. I mean, you know, even in my lifetime, there was some debate about whether smoking caused cancer. If you go back to, and the cigarette companies were, of course, complicit because they were arguing, hey, this is just an association. But we started to see over time that no matter how we looked at this relationship, we were seeing a serious connection that appeared causal between smoking and heart disease and cancer. Then you want to look at some biological or physiological corroboration. So if we're finding the statistical association between smoking and heart disease or cancer, let's look at the biology. What do we think about cigarette smoke that might affect the heart or the lungs in a way that would explain this illness? And if the biology corroborates the finding that we're seeing consistently across studies, then you can be fairly certain that we've had a major public health step forward. And, you know, not to get, because I don't want to turn people off to statistics entirely. If you look at something like smoking and heart disease, we're now clear on that. And around the world, we've saved literally millions of lives as a result.
Well, Sheila, thank you for the call. It's a great point. And let's go to Doug, who's waiting in Wilton. Hey, Doug, thanks for hanging on. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Oh, thank you. Great show. I used to teach a course to people who do what's called system safety analysis, and they were people at an arsenal who built nuclear weapons. And what I found was that an interesting overriding fact was the safety people were people, probably Democrats, who measured things in terms of their magnitude of regret. The reliability were people who measured things in terms of the likelihood of an event. And there was a particular event when two men argued whether or not a weapon system should be fired over the heads of friendly troops. It was an artillery round. And the thing was that if any of the little particles inside the gun hit you in the back of the head, it would probably kill you. And the reliability thought the likelihood was so small, he would take it. And the safety guy thought, geez, I'm not going to take it because if anybody gets hit with one of these little widgets, they're going to kill him.
Even if it's a tiny possibility?
That's right. He didn't care. If his magnitude of regret was high, he didn't care what the likelihood was when the rubber hit the road. and the reliability fellow made his assessment rather coldly on the basis of the likelihood of anybody getting hurt.
Wow. Doug, thanks for the call. Interesting concept, magnitude of regret.
Yeah, that one I haven't heard. I will say that the area of safety and security systems is one where statistics helps a lot.
Sure.
Because we can gather data on when, where, and how accidents happen, and we can quantify that. So, for example, one place where people make a lot of mistakes is not necessarily with nuclear weapons. It's beyond my purview, but between flying and driving. So that's one where we can quantify, not exactly, but we can quantify to a great degree that flying is much, 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 much safer than driving. But we also know that as human beings, our perception of risk when we're not looking at the underlying probabilities is a little bit of is flawed. You're far more likely to run into someone who's afraid of flying than you are to run into someone who's afraid of driving. So that's one where looking at the underlying data can be very helpful. And there's actually a study in the book that's somewhat alarming where after September 11th, when people were even more skittish about flying, a lot more people took to the roads. There were some economists who looked at a bump in auto fatalities in the first 3 months after the September 11th attacks, and their estimate was at least as many people died in additional automobile accidents as were killed in the original September 11th attacks.
Wow, that's pretty stunning, and I had not heard that. And it gets to something that's often said, Professor Whelan. Most of us have a very poor ability to correctly assess risk, whether it's the healthcare example that Sheila brought up or the flying example that you bring up. We're just not very good at it.
And this is where I think raw numbers help, where the flying and auto data that I just discussed, you've discussed lotteries and casinos, where I can tell you unequivocally that if you stay in a casino long enough, you're going to lose money. That's just because every bet slightly favors the house. And if you have enough bets that slightly favor the house over time, you know, over a long enough time, it becomes near certainty that you're going to lose money. So I think in places where we think we're going to win, we think we're lucky. So there's something called the gambling fallacy. So if I tell you, Laura, that we're playing roulette and it's come up black 57 times in a row, and you say, oh, I'm betting on red because it's due, I'm going to tell you it's time for you to go home, right? Because the chance of it coming up red and black are completely independent of what's happened before. That's not what people think.
Well, and
even in sports like basketball, where people are just shooting at a fixed rim, there's pretty good evidence that the whole idea of a hot hand is spurious, that if I've missed three shots in a row, the probability of me making the fourth is about the same as it was every time I shoot.
You know, it gets to the emotional factor, too, though. You said when it comes to assessing risk, yes, most of us are bad at it, but you said data helps. But we all approach that data, Professor Whelan, with some emotions involved, our own level of fear or past experiences or stories we were told when we were little.
Yeah, and fear is the enemy of rational decisions. I don't think it's in this book, but in Naked Economics, I do explore the role of emotion and investing. And there's another famous study that I do cite in that book where a group of researchers took a handful of folks who had suffered traumatic brain injuries, and the nature of the brain injury, or they'd been born with congenital issues, the nature of the brain injury was that it had taken the emotional part of their brain and rendered it useless. So these are folks who didn't feel fear, they didn't feel emotion, they didn't feel excitement. And then they had a control group who were like the rest of us. And they had these folks conduct mock investments where they were taking risks, and the risks were very clear. So, you know, you have a 1 in 2 chance of winning $50 should you do this. And the folks whose emotional judgment was shut down biologically came out much, much ahead.
Wow, they made better decisions.
Much better decisions, in part because when the folks who experienced the same fear and apprehension as the rest of us lost a couple things. So let's suppose a couple investments that should have turned out well because the probabilities were good went against them, which happens. They then stopped making that bet, even though it was still a good bet. Whereas the folks who didn't have that fear and apprehension said, well, you know, if there's a 4 out of 5 chance I'm going to win on this, I should keep doing it. And if I do it and it doesn't work out 5 times in a row, I should still do it on the 6th time. So by divorcing the fear and the emotion from the raw underlying probabilities, they came out ahead. Now, unfortunately, most of us are not very good at doing that.
Yeah. Well, let's take another call. This is Erin in Henniker. Hi, Erin. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm actually about to go into class, but I just wanted to make a comment on the SATs and GREs. I did not score very high on my SATs, so a lot of schools didn't want me as a student, but I'm now at New England College, and I'm on the dean's list. I am graduating in 3 years with my BA instead of four, and I'm also putting on a TEDx event. So I think that the schools really need to look at the SATs and see them for what they actually are.
Yeah, Erin, thanks for calling. So the statistics didn't make her look very good as a student, but Professor Whelan, here she is, you know, succeeding.
Well, this is a great callback to the earlier caller who mentioned these new algorithms in college where they look at who is likely to do well, and they essentially profile their applicants to see who's likely to do well based on these past models. They're models, and models have flaws. So let's take the SAT. We know the SAT for what it is, which is it is a cheap, easy way to glean some information about your future performance. So the correlation between your SAT scores and your first-year college grades is only about 0.3. The most it could be is 1. So there's a whole lot of performance there that is not predicted or not even associated with your SATs. Now, on the other hand, why do we like the SATs? Well, we like the SATs because when you look at grades across the country, some high schools are easy, some high schools are not easy, some courses are hard, some courses are not hard, just like we talked about with GPA. So if I want a standardized measure of aptitude across all these schools, I'm going to give you a test. It takes 3 hours. I get a numerical score. I can compare it across students. So in some ways, this is a great call because it encapsulates everything about statistics. The SAT is not useless, but it's also not perfect in terms of predicting future performance. And of course, sophisticated admissions officers understand that. Those that are pressed for time and money probably do not. If you got a formula, then you may well not do justice to students like the most recent caller.
You know, it gets to what you said right at the beginning of the program, which is statistics tell you a lot, but they also don't tell you a lot. They leave out a lot, such as how our caller, you know, might have done in other courses or her ambitions in life or experiences she had had. And all that's left aside by that one raw number. You know, just picking up on what you said about gleaning information and how statistics like the SAT help us glean information. Boy, we could do a whole hour, couldn't we, Professor Whelan, on how marketers, especially retailers, are using statistics to help increase their sales. Again, we could talk for many, many, many hours on this, but there's a great story in the book about how the giant retailer Target used statistics to try and sell items to pregnant women. And they got into some trouble on this. It's a really funny story. I'd love for you to share it with us.
Yeah, so this bleeds right into how much information is too much information, the whole privacy issue, which that will be another hour
yes.
for somebody to take on. But in the case of Target, and this is a story that comes to us from the New York Times Magazine because they had a journalist who followed the statisticians around at Target. Target discovered that pregnant women become very loyal shoppers. They develop a retail bond. So if you start shopping someplace when you're pregnant, you're likely to be a loyal shopper for a long time. That made it important to them to get pregnant women into their stores. So they had a head start in that they, like other retailers, have a baby registry. So it's like a wedding registry. If you're going to have a child and you're going to have a baby shower, you can register for gifts. So at that point, you go to Target, you tell them you're pregnant, you tell them probably when you're due. And that's fine because that's entirely voluntary. You've agreed to give them that information. But here's where it gets kind of interesting. Target then said, okay, huh, we know these women are pregnant. Let's look at their shopping habits. And they discovered, for example, that pregnant women start buying unscented soaps. They buy bigger bags of cotton balls. They buy prenatal vitamins. There are about 20-some things that they formulated into a pregnancy prediction index. And they said, huh, if we look at all of our other shoppers who are scanning their cards with their frequent shopper cards, we can probably predict among that pool who is likely to be pregnant.
Even if they haven't registered.
Right, of course, if they haven't registered, because suddenly they're buying prenatal vitamins, they're buying cotton balls. So they start implementing this, and they're sending coupons to people they think are likely to be pregnant to get them into the store. And there's a father in Minneapolis, and his high school-aged daughter starts getting coupons for diapers and cribs and things like that. And he gets very angry. He calls the manager and says, look, what are you trying to do? My daughter's in high school. She needs to finish school. Why in the world are you putting these ideas into her head that she needs to be having a baby? And the store manager said, we're really sorry. It won't happen again. And in fact, the store manager felt so bad about it, he called back 2 or 3 days later to apologize again. At that point, the father said, well, actually, now it's my turn to apologize. It turns out there have been some things going on in the house I didn't know about. I think that was his exact quote. And my daughter is pregnant, which means that the statisticians at Target had figured out that this girl was pregnant before her father had.
Wow. Well, that story just says it all when it comes to the ability of companies to use statistics in very successful ways.
Right. I mean, it gets to this point that it's powerful, it works, but it's never smarter, wiser, or more honest than the people using them.
What's the big takeaway, do you hope, Professor Whelan, that readers take away from this book, especially those who weren't in love with statistics as students?
I think it's more important than you might realize. It's not as hard as esoteric as you might think, but it behooves you to understand what's going on because the data are not going away, and the statistics are the tools that we interpret the data, and they're everywhere. They're in baseball, they're in law enforcement, they're in retail. And whether you're in business or just an informed citizen, you need to understand how these numbers are being used.
Well, thank you very much for giving us our time this morning.
It was my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Charles Whelan, Dartmouth College professor, author of the international bestseller Naked Economics and the new book we talked about, Naked Statistics, Stripping the Dread from the Data. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer this week is Mike Danielli. Our producer is Ellen Grimm. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our intern is Faith Mikesell. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange's executive producer is Keith Shields. And I'm Laura Kanoy.